I'm joined here by Hall of Fame journalist and sportscaster Paul Page, a man who has literally spanned the globe to bring you the constant variety of sports, as they used to say on ABC's Wide World of Sports in that intro. You've covered everything from sumo wrestling to competitive eating to hostage situations and, of course, the greatest spectacle in racing, the Indianapolis 500. Thank you for being with us here on Voices of the West Side.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you very much.
And, you know, like I said in the intro, you've been all around the world covering news and sports. You also moved around a lot early in your childhood. So how did that kind of set you up for your career of globetrotting to cover sports and events?
Well, I was a military brat, so I just followed what the family was doing. And then didn't really expect to travel in my later life. I knew I wanted to do Indy, and I wanted to do an American series, but I had no idea that the networks were going to send me all over the place. I kind of, we were in Stuttgart, Germany, before we came back to the States, and then Sport Sheridan, Illinois, and my parents wanted me to go down to the Indy 500. And I didn't want to go because I was a Formula One guy. I'd been to the Nürburgring, mm-hmm. and say that, no, you're going. Your uncle wants to take you, and that's it. And so when I got there, the ceremonies convinced me that I wanted to be part of the Indy 500. The race hadn't even started yet.
The pre-race ceremonies.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So cool.
Paul Page is joining us here on Voices of the West Side. You know him as well, many things. Like we said, you've done a wide variety of sports, but of course, here in Indianapolis, you're probably most well-known for your coverage of the Indy 500, but you also worked in news, and I was wondering, you know, as a teacher who teaches broadcast, what did that news background bring to your sports coverage as well?
Well, it meant a great deal. Because news was different. I was primarily in radio news, so I did some television. But it was pretty different. I mean, we did a lot of live from the scene reports, and if they weren't live, we did what we called a roser, a recorded on scene report, where you acted if you were live, but you were recording and sent it in. We didn't try and pretend that it was live. I mean, we said it wasn't, but still, you had whatever the background sounds were and whatever was going on there. So that really made for some good radio. And then having that experience, when you think about it, the Indianapolis 500 is really a giant news event. I mean, you're talking a playing field 2.5 miles long, a race of 200 laps, and one of the 33 drivers could make the move at any time during the race that actually makes a difference. So, Being trained to cover stuff like that, and of course with the long involvement and mentoring from Sid Collins, it prepared me, and I was really happy that it did because I love the job.
Yeah, you mentioned Sid Collins there, and I was going to ask you about Sid. Your first race as chief announcer was in 1977, and it was shortly after Sid's death. So, that being your first race, you were obviously well prepared to step into the role, even though I'm sure it must have been a very tough time emotionally for you.
Yeah, he had warned me that 77, actually what he intended for 77, was that he start the race and I finish it. Mm. But fate intervened on us, and unfortunately Sid passed away on the 2nd of May. And what, 24 days later, I was doing the Indy 500.
I've heard the late Bob Jenkins, who I know you were a big mentor to, talk about how difficult it is to be the radio voice of the 500 as far as the responsibilities that you have when you are making those decisions. Just talked to actually Mark James yesterday about this. You're kind of calling all the shots. What was that like for you?
Well, I loved it in television. It's interesting. Bob didn't like radio, and I didn't like television all that much. But in radio, you are calling all the shots, and you're directing the flow of the broadcast, and you're setting your other announcers up to do this or to do that. And television, you got a guy in a dark truck who has probably only ridden in a yellow cab trying to tell you what the race is. And that was interesting, to say the least.
Well, you having a motorsports background, I'm sure, helped you, obviously, in the booth. But certainly, maybe sometimes you were hearing things from a direction standpoint that maybe you thought differently. I don't know. On the radio, you get to make those decisions. In TV, maybe you don't. And I think it's interesting, actually, on YouTube, a lot of those, when they used to do the satellite feed and somebody recorded the entire satellite feed, you can go back and watch that. And I always find it fascinating to hear what goes on during the commercial breaks.
You're not supposed to listen to that.
Well, you know, the chatter back and forth, and I think there was the Kevin Kogan accident. Sam Posey's trying to get the telestrator to work correctly, and
that was
always very interesting to hear. But
yeah, that was the first live race, so had some issues with that race. So. And the biggest issue was that as they're coming back to green for the final several laps of the race, Sam Posey, this guy, decided that was a good time to talk to Bobby Rahal. And I think the answer, or to Kevin Kogan, the answer was, I'm a little busy right now.
Yes. Yes, we're here in the booth. I'm a little busy right now. I'll get back to you.
Yeah.
But, you know,
talk to me in 2 minutes when I've won.
But, you know, now you watch the broadcast on Fox, and they've had several years now to kind of hone the craft and see what ABC did and what NBC did before them. But early on, your first, second year in the booth there, it was still live, flag-to-flag coverage was still in its infancy. What was that like?
Oh, it was – I mean, we had – again, it's such a huge event. And it's physically huge. I mean, we've had as many as 42 cameras, I think, at one point. I think they have even more now. But it was kind of overwhelming because the people I was working with, I was accustomed to doing live because of the radio and because I'd also been working with NBC for several years and from 1979 onward doing the then kart races, and those were live. So I was kind of accustomed to that world, but the ABC folks, on the other hand, were accustomed to laying it down on tape, editing it, and playing it back later. So suddenly, when they're hit with the instantaneous aspect of live coverage, that kind of threw them for a loop for a short while. But they were the incredible people. The technicians, the crew, they figured it out pretty quick. The producers and the mostly producers, the executive producer, it took them a little longer because they were very much accustomed to being in charge. But in that case, they suddenly realized there's nothing to be in charge of. It's just happening, and we've got to stay with it. So they learned, and we all learned, and I think eventually, like maybe the second year out, though both the first and second year that we were doing it, that I was doing it live, they had a year, 2 years before me. But we got Emmys for Best Sports Special. We figured it out, and we made it fun, you know, having Bobby and Hunter and Sam Posey in the booth and them always disagreeing with one another. And it became a joy to do. First year, yeah, it was a little tough because we were all getting our feet wet for the first time.
I could imagine just 600 and some acres of land, and you've got – so many different stories beside what's going on the track, what's going off the track. And, you know, if there's a smoke, I think 1 year, maybe this was before you took over as the voice, there was a smoke bomb that goes off and you have to figure out why there's smoke coming through, drifting across the track or things like that. I can imagine just trying to keep track of that, and the weather was always a factor. And
oh yeah, it's raining in Terre Haute.
Yeah, there's a window over Terre Haute now. I remember, yes. I think it was the 2007 race. I was listening on the radio, and it was raining at my house, and they were still running. And I live right by the airport, and I knew it was, you know, it's coming. So I think you would always mention how the race teams would have people stationed out west before all the weather apps and things. Yeah.
Yeah, they had that, and they have private airplanes that would fly out and find the leading edge of the squall line. And there were people that had, well, we've got 10 guys between Terre Haute and here that is pretty much on line with where the storms come. And so the guy would call in and say, okay, it just started raining here. And then the next guy. And then so you could decide what your whole tactical situation would be based on that, because you wanted to be in the lead if it started raining. And so it was whether or not you were going to just keep the pace or really race for the lead. All of those things had a great effect, and they were. I love the strategy. I love the tactics of the race, and that's kind of what I do in the booth now. Is because I'm in the back of the radio booth, though they foolishly give me a microphone, and every now and then I turn it on and say, you know, well, this happened. He did that there. And in fact, in 2016 at the 100th race, I kept telling them to keep an eye on Rossi, and the Mark James and the gang were saying, oh, he's ninth, there's not a chance. They didn't say anything. So finally I turned my mic on and said, we got to keep an eye on Rossi. And again, they said, well, he's ninth. I said, yeah, but he's doing like 173 miles an hour. He's not going to stop. Oh, that's not possible. So yeah, he didn't. And he won.
He made it stretch. that's for sure.
Yeah, he sure did. Ran out of fuel on the last lap.
And, you know, that's the other part of this race, because, you know, whereas when you were doing CART and things like that, you had multiple 500 races on the schedule. You had Pocono and Michigan and and those races.
Ontario, Fontana.
Yeah. And now this is kind of like a unicorn for the IndyCar series, because it's the only 500-mile super speedway race that they have. And it's quite different than the other ovals that they run. So I can imagine that the data and everything that they have, it's based year to year on the 500 only. So you do have those different strategy things that develop. And that's what makes this race so great, I think, is you have so many different ways that you can win it. You talk about Rossi using the clutch and coast to win and things like that. And then, you know, obviously so many different ways to win that race. And that's one of the things that makes it amazing.
Well, when you think about it this way, once they pass the 250-mile mark, they're in totally unknown territory. Mm-hmm. They don't do that at any other time during the year. And so like this week, I went out to the tests because I want to know how far a fuel tank can really go. I want to know exactly how far the tires will take you. And then that's going to lead in, like in this race, that'll lead into some pretty interesting strategies throughout the race, because both the tire and the fuel now has effect. It used to be that the tire outlasted the fuel tank, but now not so much. And of course, as the tire is running, it's losing its grip every lap because it's wearing off rubber. So you have to take all of that into account. And that's what makes it fun for me. Plus it's just, I mean, it's exciting beyond all belief. And I love to just, I'm there ready to watch at 10 o'clock because that's when the ceremonies start. And that's when the Indy 500 starts for me.
Paul Page is joining us here on Voices of the West Side, and I've got just a couple more questions for you, Paul. Motorsports in general, one thing I've always appreciated about how you covered the 500, maybe more so than some of the other announcers, everybody has to have their own style. And one thing I loved about what you would do is you would sometimes just lay out and let the pictures kind of tell the story. And you can't really do that in radio, but you can in television. So when did you make that decision to, well, I'm just going to lay back and just let the pictures tell the story?
Well, in several broadcasts, I would just say, look, they've been looking at this battle for the lead for the last 20 minutes. What more can I say other than something probably incredibly stupid? So why not just not talk and watch it? And so I would on occasion just say, you know, there's 10 miles to go, and then shut up. And then when something happened, like with Little Al and Fittipaldi, I was being quiet. And so when they clashed in the North End, now I've got the opportunity to really jump on top of it and make it really exciting because we've been running along at a kind of a quiet level. And but to tell the audience what they surely know just seems stupid to me.
Paul Page, once again, joining us here on Voices of the West Side. And one thing I also appreciate, and this I think maybe comes from your background as a news person, perhaps kind of more than some other sports, motorsports journalists get to really know the drivers that you're covering.
Yeah.
And there were many times, unfortunately, that you might have a serious accident or something that you would wait until to identify. I was just watching back the race at Elkhart Lake in 1990 when A.J. Foyt went off and had the horrible accident, and you waited. And so many times you don't hear that. And I'm not talking about what Will Buxton or what they're doing now. I know that they strive to get things right, but you waited so long. How difficult was that for you as a broadcaster? I have over here on my desk behind me, I have an autograph from Greg Moore, another driver, where there was a very serious incident, and you had to...
Actually, it's good that you bring him up, because he's probably the best example. When he crashed at Fontana, and when I saw the crash, I knew it was fatal.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you just see enough of that, and you know, and that was no question in my mind. And our booth was attached to race control and separated by a pane of glass. And the chief steward, Wally Donnenbach, was on the other side. We both saw that crash, and we just looked at each other.
Mm.
So I started backing the race down right away because we didn't have any information and, you know, official information. We had what we knew. And you had to keep quiet. I'm not going to be the one to tell mom that her son just died.
Mm.
And we have to show we're part of that community. We live in that world, so we have to show respect to the world. Now, sometimes it hasn't been done, which really frosts me when that happens. Not on any telecast I've been on, but you know, you do kind of live with that, and you kind of in the back of your mind are constantly thinking, what do you say? When do you say what? How do you approach it? Well, you can't really plan it because every circumstance is different. I mean, I covered several fatalities live, and it's just the most horrible moment there is. One, you're losing a friend. Like Greg Moore and I were close.
Mm-hmm.
And the morning of that race, he and I were talking, and he was on the scooter that he had crashed the day before. And he, you know, he had a special brace for his hand because he had hurt himself. But he still, you know, he wasn't going to give up driving. So he and I were laughing about it, you know, and I'm saying that, well, maybe they put some Novocaine in your butt too, to, you know, kind of numb out everything. And so then, you know, 2 hours later, he's gone.
Mm.
That's so devastating. And they're such vital people. I mean, they're superlative athletes, though. There are people that argue with me on that, and they won't win, but that's okay.
I think I know who you're talking about.
Uh-huh.
I think I know who you're talking about on that one.
Right. Yep.
Paul Page joining us here on Voices of the West Side, and I don't want to end on a somber note. So what is maybe your favorite call that you've had over the years at either on the radio or on TV?
Well, on television, it was the Ellinger Jr. Fittipaldi race because I had kept quiet. And I really was working to try to make it, for want of a better word, artistic. You always want to make the 500 so very, very special. And one of the things about it is, like, if today you make a mistake on this show, your next show, you correct it. You know, almost right away, you can correct it. The Indy 500, you can't really make that correction until the next race. And you don't want to put yourself in that position. You want to make sure everything you do and say is 100%. So that alone is part of the big challenge of it, and part of also what makes it fun.
And you talk also, and I've talked to Mark James about this, your calls live forever with the Indy 500. You know, we do a Friday night football game and it's gone. It's done. But the calls of the Indy 500, the last lap calls, the Fittipaldi Unser Jr. crash call, those live on well past when they're on the air. So I can't. Yeah. That's a lot of pressure for you, but also you have to be correct, like you said, because that call is going to live forever.
Yeah, but it's fun. That's the great challenge of the whole thing, to do it, put some drama into it, put some life into it, and make sure that it's right. By the way, if Mark didn't mention it, there is a display at the IMS Museum right now of broadcasters throughout the years, going all the way back to 1922, when the first race was broadcast from the track. And if you haven't seen it, for broadcasters especially, I think there's a lot. There's a lot there for the general public, but the broadcasters especially would probably really enjoy that.
It's amazing what they've done to the museum.
I know. It's so good. I was there today.
Yeah.
I've been there so much. I just love going there.
I used to love to go when the cars were just there, and now everything else that they've added, it is just phenomenal. And the way the facility looks as well is just phenomenal. Would you drive by it, and it just gleams. And, you know, the Holman George family were great and amazing to this community, and thank goodness we had them. But my word, you know, not taking sides here or anything, but the amount of money that Penske has put into that place just to make it look nice is amazing.
That's him. That's the way he is. It's got to look perfect. It's got to be premier and pristine.
Penske perfect. There you go.
Yep. There you go. Use that.
Yeah. Thank you so much for taking time to join us and being on our show. And
you're welcome.
You know, from my perspective, you probably hear this a lot, but you were a big part of my childhood growing up. Listening to the 500, then watching the replay of the 500, because it was not ever live here back then, but watching the replay of the Indy 500, and then through the cart everything else that you've done, I feel like I know you, so it is amazing to actually sit down and at least virtually through the power of phones interview you. So thank you so much.
Oh, I'm glad to do it. It's fun. Fun to talk about it. I'll talk with anybody about it. It's just so much fun.
All right. Well, Paul Page joining us here on Voices of the West Side.